Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Guy Chiarello to the broadcast. Guy is the president of First Data Corporation, an $11 billion global payment technology solutions company that handles almost half of all U.S. credit and debit transactions. In that role, Guy focuses on innovation, product development, and technological systems while engaging customers and business leaders to create and enhance First Data's market solutions. Prior to his role at First Data Corporation, Guy was the Chief Information Officer at JPMorgan Chase, where he had responsibility for technology across seven lines of business and helped drive innovation, including the creation of a suite of digital banking platforms. Prior to that, he was an IT executive at Morgan Stanley. He received his Bachelor of Science degree in business from the College of New Jersey. I recently caught up with Guy at his office in New York City, and our conversation covered world-class IT Principle 1, people, as we discussed the methods he's used to build world-class teams. Principle 2, infrastructure, as we discussed how he balances security with the need for innovation. And Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as we discussed how his experience as a CIO shapes his relationship with his current CIO at First Data Corporation. We also discussed how he thinks about the evolution of digital business, strategic priorities of the organization, and his views on future technology trends, including blockchain, as well as a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Guy Chiarello, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So, Guy, I thought we'd begin with your role as president of First Data Corporation. You've been in this role for 2.5, coming up on 3 years. Can you talk a bit about the definition? What's within your purview in this role?
Sure. It's been an exciting time, and it's evolved a lot since July 2013. But if I simplified it, there's really three aspects of the job every day. One is really helping Frank Bisignano, our CEO, run the company. So that's the day-to-day operations, the things that happen inside the company, making it work well for clients and making it work well for the overall company and the employees that are part of it every day. The second thing is around clients. I spend a lot of time in the client space, not only helping sell our solutions, but most importantly, understanding their experiences, their needs, and help them focus on a forward-looking strategy where First Data can help them. And this is a very unique company. So explaining the company and helping them understand the value that it can bring to them and their business is key. And then the third function, which is really what, I've grown up prepared to do every day, is around the innovation, the engineering, and the technical operations of the company. So that's engineering our products, solutions, defining a strategy, which is really around not only innovation, but execution, the products and capabilities of the company every day. And then, actually running the company from a technology perspective. So even though this is about beyond the CIO, I still, have my hands in the technology function every day. I do have a CIO and a CTO inside the company. But this is a technology company. At the end of the day, that is who we are and what we do, and we use those capabilities to deliver great solutions to clients worldwide.
You talked about strategy. Can you talk a little bit about what some of the priorities within your strategy are right now?
The company is multifaceted. So we have customers that are, 4,000 plus banks as our customers. We are the outsourced party or the enabler for banks who are trying to deliver debit and credit solutions to cardholders around the world. On the other end of the spectrum, we have 6 million merchant locations where we deliver everything from point of sale and payment enablement. In between, we have the largest independent debit network. We're 28% of the world's e-commerce payment activity. We've got a growing presence in card-not-present activity, so those are digital, mobile-type payments. And in a lot of ways, as you bring those things together, really we are the go-to solution for people who either want to enable payments or deliver loans, credit, or debit capabilities in the marketplace. And, that's in 100-plus countries on an everyday basis.
Both here as well as in your role as CIO at JPMorgan Chase, innovation has been part of your set of responsibilities. Yeah. I'd be curious, how do you people define innovation in a variety of different ways, big I, small I? Yeah. How do you define innovation? What are some of the metrics you use to determine whether or not the organization is innovating appropriately or not?
You know, it's a really hard measure. You can talk about it as the big I or little I, but there's no I in innovation. You know, you've heard that before.
Right.
I in team. Innovation happens in so many different ways. I mean, innovation can be around a process. It could be around a new piece of technology. It could be a way you apply a technology. I mean, my whole career, my mindset has been around how do you bring new ideas to the marketplace? And that could be to businesses or consumers. And to me, that's innovation. And, I grew up at Morgan Stanley. I thought, an amazing firm. I was the only person to ever come from the IT department to ascend to the CIO level at Morgan Stanley. It was always a primary or premier business person that took that CIO role because it was so critical to the business. And people traditionally in IT were not thought to be great business people. So, from the day I joined there, which was December 1984, I swore to myself that I was going to be the best business person and best technologist in the company. So what I did was I spent a lot of time around innovation. And I spent time around innovation as a technologist. I spent time around it also as a banking team. I was part of the M&A banking team. Great people like Joe Perella and other great bankers that are still there today in the tech practice. And I got a chance to learn about what happens in Silicon Valley, Silicon Alley, and other parts of the world, and would look at 100 to 200 private tech companies a year to really understand where things were going. I'd also spend time with the premier CEOs in the technology marketplace, certainly as a big buyer, and began to glue those things together to say, where's the marketplace going? How do I take advantage of it? How do I plug that into our company? And how does it create leverage for us going forward? So I've been, my process for 20 years now has been to just study what's happening at the marketplace from small to tall, understand, learn, and pick the signal through the noise and those trends and apply it to whatever business I was part of.
Mm-hmm. Innovation is fundamentally about risk-taking. If you're batting 1,000, you're not innovating. Security is about risk mitigation. So you could see those as actually pointed in different directions, and getting that balance correct can be a challenge for a lot of organizations. I wonder, especially in this environment where security issues are becoming so much more complex, how do you think about that balance between risk-taking and risk mitigation?
You could worry yourself to death. I think there's a saying that only the paranoid survive, but you at the same time, it can't stifle innovation. So if you took First Data handles 40% of the world's payment transactions. That means that we have to be best in class at securing cardholder information, at securing transactions, but also making sure they authorize appropriately, because fraud and security could almost be looked at hand in hand. And there's a lot of investment and numerous trends in this space. But the smartest thing is you have to have a great group of people who come from everything from agency backgrounds and technology backgrounds. You have to have a layered set of capabilities and defenses. You have to build state-of-the-art systems that really use analytics to identify not just fraud, but trends that look like anomalistic behavior. I talk about it less and less as security now and more as trust. Because at the end of the day, if First Data can bring trust to payments in all channels, then commerce will continue to evolve. And we'll be the player. We are, whether it's Apple Pay, Google Pay, Samsung Pay, MCX, you name the payment method, whether it's a card from a phone or from a computer screen, First Data doesn't care. Its job is to make sure that it's processed in a trusted and secure way on behalf of the bank, the brand, the network, or the client. So that's the mindset we take to it. It's a premier focus, and you're never good enough at it. You're never good enough. You've never invested enough. But instinctively, you have to figure out where the right medium is between being, paranoid and insecure.
Mm-hmm. among your many accomplishments at JP Morgan Chase was helping the bank think more digitally, being sort of a digitally minded organization and rendering more of what it had traditionally done in a digital form. You did so before that term was nearly as in vogue as it is today.
Yeah.
So I suppose one could say the world's catching up with you a little bit. I'm curious what you think about the whole topic of digital. In some ways, it's one of those terms that, or a topic, I should say, that's been around actually for quite some time. It's now just being applied and leveraged more broadly across many different industries. Having thought about these sorts of topics for a lot longer, perhaps, than the average executive, what do you think about the evolution of the of digital of business?
Yeah, you know, this was, JP Morgan was so much fun. I mean, it was really one of the best roles I ever had, because it was a big bank with a lot of scale, which means if you had great ideas, scale distribution really was to your advantage. And when I got there, very small, I'd spent most of my time building trading systems. And when I got to JP Morgan, I had this great opportunity in the Chase Bank to revolutionize the way consumers did business with the bank, as well as the way institutions did business with the bank. But some of the cool things there, when I got there was no mobile site, zero. You know, now I don't know what the current numbers are, but I think when I left there were, 12 million active customers on a 30-day basis using the technology to conduct their day-to-day activities. But, one of the more interesting things, this was back to little ideas. If you walked into a Chase Bank, the teller probably only had about 10 to 15% of its transactions as digital in 2007. I don't know what the number would be today, but when I left, it was well over 80% and probably well over 90%, except for, the small business transactions that happened in bulk. But go back to, we were the first to do the deposit-friendly ATM. People used to walk up to an ATM, checks in an envelope, drop it in a pouch, Brink's truck would pick it up, take it to an airport, fly it to a processing center, take them out. People would rekey those transactions. Days later, funds would be resolved. All we did was we took the same scanner that was in the branch and put it in the ATM with some innovative companies, and bang, Brink trucks went away, fuel for airplanes went away, thousands of people in processing center didn't have to do menial jobs anymore, funds were available immediately, and that was the beginning of a revolution. And then we invented, then smartphones came out with cameras. We said, why not use the camera on a phone to take a picture of a check? It's got the routing number, it's got the account number. Why not use that as the point of record so people don't even have to go to an ATM or have to go to a branch to cash a check? And bang, that happened and got it to scale. And then, we did P2P payments, QuickPay. These were things that were, I feel like, it's hard to say exactly, but I feel like today we're a couple of years ahead of their time. People are advertising them on TV today as new. And these were things we did back many, many, many years ago. And that was innovation. So it was cool technology. It wasn't something that somebody else couldn't do. It was taking an idea, a set of things that people had in their, in their hand every day or had the capabilities to use every day, and put them into what we called a standard business process or consumer process. And it took off like wildfire. And, and today it's the way people do banking. They go to a branch to do a certain set of things, but it's an omni-channel approach. And if they want to use their phone, the web, a branch, or an ATM, it all works the same way.
Yeah.
Really fun.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that even dating back to the mid-80s, you thought about the role as a technologist as a business role. Today, even, there are still CIOs, heads of technology for organizations, who, if you ask them who their customers are, they will say they're colleagues. They're thus sort of like declaring a distance between what they do and the ultimate value, how revenue is earned by the enterprise, for instance. So you certainly were well ahead of the curve from that perspective. And I can only imagine that that's one of the reasons why you have gone from CIO to now a position definitively above it. I'd love to have you validate that, but also learn from you what your experience as a CIO, what you drew from that in order to now expand your areas of responsibility so far beyond the role.
You hit on the key theme, which is, I wish more people in a CIO role could be more commercial. And commercial can be defined depending on, where you happen to work. There was a guy named Rob Carter at FedEx who I thought was one of the best. He was a guy who I admired for a long time because I thought he brought that mindset to the job. And, at FedEx, he really thought about how a person would interact with the product. And I did the same thing, whether it was Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, and now, at First Data, I live it. I mean, I'm with clients every day. It feels like, more hours of the day than I even ever expected. But, it's great because if you listen well, the key to being successful is listening, not talking. And I always considered myself an exceptional listener. So that was part one. The second thing was Joe Plumeri, who's one of our directors here, wrote a book called The Power of Being Yourself. And there's a chapter in there called Playing in Traffic. I always played in traffic my whole life. I was playing in traffic with clients, in this case with bankers, in other cases with technology leaders. Playing in traffic put me in a lot of scenarios that got me a chance to, you know, to really think about different ways of implementing things. Most importantly, it taught me can do. And it's really about what are the, you know, when you put yourself in a difficult situation, A, you know, you say, what would I do if in the other person's seat? And B, what do I have to do to make it successful? Because technologists are often unbelievable debuggers. So the first thing they'll do is tell you why something won't work instead of how to make something work. So those, you know, I think those are some key themes. The most memorable time in my life, it was sort of a pinnacle, was at the, I forget the year, it was the Google IPO. And Google wanted to do something different than every other company in their IPO. They wanted to do a Dutch auction. And it was unheard of at the time. And Michael Grimes, who was the head of banking, called me. And I was on the phone with him. He said, this is Michael. I'm going to ask you something. You'll have a split second to answer. But if you say yes, you might end up being one of the most famous people in your role ever. And if you say no, you know, you'll never get the chance to be prominent. But let me also tell you, if you say yes and you fail, you'll be the GOAT of Wall Street. And it was, are you willing to build the software to do a Dutch auction for Google? And it has to be done in 60 days. We're going live in 90 days, and the requirements aren't even defined yet. And in a split second, I said, yes, I'm in. And the team embraced it. Ben Fried was part of that team, who's now the CIO of Google. There are a few other people who went on to work with you know, at different companies. But we built the Dutch auction with Eric Schmidt at Google, who I'd known at Sun as the CTO for many years before that. And we did something that, you know, whether it made history from, you know, being used 100 times after that or not, it was unique, and it was really about the personality of Google. And we did something special, and it was successful, and it worked in a variety of different ways. And that's really the kind of person I want to personify, and I want other CIOs to feel that way, which is even things that seem impossible are possible if you put your mind to it and you have great partnerships. And I believed in the people I was going to be working with, and that was a turning point for me.
So you were wired differently. How did you recruit a team that was wired the same way? The extent to which you were drawing from the average, there's perhaps the answer to the question, but the average technologist wouldn't necessarily be wired or have the experience to elicit information from across the organization, tap into the insights, for example, from Silicon Valley, as you described before, yeah, and draw some connections between what you're hearing and what's possible. And I wonder, to what extent have you found that the people that you bring in have the ability to unlock this capability, are there specific things you've looked for traditionally in hiring a team around you as an IT executive?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I was the head of recruiting for University of Penn Wharton when I was at Morgan Stanley, University of Delaware and Syracuse when I was at JP Morgan. But I also hired high school graduates, college dropouts, and, you know, also people from great, you know, Division III schools that bred either good athletes who weren't on scholarship or good military people who had structured disciplines in their lives. But what I really looked for was inquisitiveness. Now, let's not make any mistake. Morgan Stanley was a fabulous company. JP Morgan was a fabulous, so I had a great platform. Banking also lures great people because there's better pay there. These are companies that spend 8 to 12% of their net revenue on technology. They really are the closest thing to a technology company outside of a tech company. So it was a great platform to recruit from, so I can't take all the credit. But boy, I looked for people who were disciplined. I looked for people who were inquisitive. I would often ask them questions that were, you know, way out of the norm of a standard tech interview or business, because I really wanted to know, could they think on their feet? Could they create a winning situation out of a difficult scenario? How would they solve this problem? And then most importantly, how much confidence do they have in themselves? Because if you want to be an innovator, you can't second guess yourself. You have to be willing to fail. You got to put it out there. You got to go 110% at your idea. But equally importantly, you have to be a team player. I played sports my whole life, but I always played team sports. So it wasn't about the I. Back to this thing about I again. It was really about, can you put combinations of people together to be successful, and then can they build on top of that? Can they recruit? So the team I had at Morgan Stanley was a completely different team that I had at JP Morgan, which is a completely different team that I have at First Data. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is it's not the political administrations. The Democrats don't come out and 200, you know, Republicans come in. This was about picking a group of people and making them successful, and then picking another group of people and making them successful. And that was as much about me wanting to prove to myself that it wasn't about a crony scenario. It was really about, you know, a consistent pattern for developing talent and leadership, which could then, you know, do the same for itself. And before you know it, you get transformation. And that's, First Data is a transformation story. Mm-hmm. It's always about people, process, technology, clients, investors. I mean, it's transformation at every corner.
You're now the boss of a CIO, Chris Augustin.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, having held the role, what kind of a boss are you to the role? I would imagine, of course, you know his job quite well, and can ask questions better than the average CFO, let's say, who's the boss of a CIO who's never held the role, perhaps may or may not have a great deal of sophistication in terms of the questions he or she might ask of the CIO. Can you talk a bit about your own perspectives now in your relationship with the CIO, having been one?
It's an easier question to answer today than it might have been 10 years ago. I was a very good athlete, a great baseball player, and I know what I put my son through as he played sports. And I wasn't such, you know, I was a great coach, but I wasn't necessarily, you know, the perfect leader because, you know, I was maybe too tough on the wrong issues. It really taught me how to be a good boss for Chris Augustin and Mike Manos, who happens to be our CTO. And what that means is that I actually understand technology from the ground up, left, right, top down. I mean, I really still want to be the best at that aspect of my own personal life. But my job is to teach them. It's to give them all the experiences that I've had. It's to teach them how to look around corners. It's to give them the perspectives of how to partner with key people in the industry to be successful. What are the key capabilities to look at in software? And how to really get people to work efficiently and quickly as teams to develop new solutions. So I'd like to think today, I probably would have answered it differently 10 years ago because I might not have thought I was good at it then. But I think today I'm very good at it because it's about mentoring and leading and guiding much more than being the puppet or the puppeteer pulling the strings. Now, I also learned from it because my boss, CEO Frank Bisignano, is also pretty adept in technology and operations. So he's been, he's been a fabulous influence in my own career and been a great boss for the last 9 years, 10 years.
Across multiple companies.
Yep. He was similar to the way that I operate today. I mean, he was a guiding hand rather than a forceful day-to-day, minute-to-minute influence. And I think that helped me mature as well and learn how to be better at this. But I've worked for great leadership. I mean, if I attribute anything to success, it's really being around really terrific people who have gone on to be CEOs of companies and, really been very successful in their career personally and professionally.
You mentioned earlier the tie that you've had to universities. You led recruiting at Penn and Wharton. You've had relationships with Syracuse, the University of Delaware, you mentioned. I've learned that this has been kind of a strategy of yours, is establishing partnerships with universities. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about the rationale behind it of targeting some universities and developing a special relationship with them, presumably for talent acquisition, if not other things.
Yeah. First, I thought Morgan Stanley had one of the best recruiting programs in the world. Now, I'd been at that company for a long time, so I was somewhat jaded by it. But, boy, we recruited some unbelievable talent, had a great program, brought people through it. The retention after 5 years and, in those days had to be still well into the 70-80% range, which was unheard of. So we recruited great people. We taught and trained them. We fulfilled their career aspects. We paid them well. And it taught me the value of bringing, a constant pipeline of cultivating people. When I got to J.P. Morgan, the key thing was that jobs were leaving New York State. And Frank came to me one day and he said, look, let's do two things. Let's provide jobs for veterans and give back to the country. And let's put jobs in New York, even though they can't be in New York City at the time. And what better place than Syracuse University? And we went up to Syracuse University, spent time with the chancellor, the development offices, and we said, let's build a curriculum, an IT curriculum in Syracuse that could be exported anywhere to any university around the country. Let's give back. And equally importantly, let's build on campus a presence, and we built a cybersecurity lab, took over Lyman Hall at Syracuse University, and did something that I thought was unique and special that had both J.P. Morgan's imprint on it, but also Syracuse University's imprint. And that went well, and the reason for University of Delaware is that most of our credit card and a bunch of our retail operations were based in Wilmington, Delaware, which is where the University of Delaware was not far from. And the same thing, the president at the time, Pat Harker, was from University of Penn Wharton, so the synergy was there, understood, a lot of commonalities, and we did a similar thing at the University of Delaware and cut some ribbons in Pernell Hall, and there's great presence there, and, it's really, it's a story. So, for me, it's all about, in this case, it's all about education. How do you give back? STEM is the big theme now. That was the basis for a lot of what we've done, but I think bringing kids in early and teaching them the commercial components or the commercial applications of what they learned in their curriculum is really important in the future of this company and those other companies I was part of as well.
I wonder, for others, you've started to list off a number of very important aspects that allowed you to rise from CIO to your current role as president of First Data. Are there other aspects we've not talked about that you would offer as counsel to a sitting CIO who has the aspiration to go beyond that role? Other things you would suggest that they think about doing in their career?
I hit a lot of them, but I believe that, first and foremost, if you're the CIO, you have to feel like you are a business partner with the team that's assembled in your company to lead that company. You have to feel that. You have to act like that. You have to, fight your way into understanding every aspect of the business to be successful. I always felt that as the leader of technology, I had to understand the business process better than the business because I had to break it into small components, program it, and make it work. So I think it's not beyond the way most CIOs think. It's just in every, in different segments of the marketplace, it's not as respected as others. In financial services, it's highly respected. Maybe in others, it's not. But most importantly, I think the CIO just has to be a business person, part of their day, has to be commercially thinking about everything that goes on, every dollar spent, every effort uncovered, and really has to be at the leadership table of the company. And if they're not, I believe in this millennium, the company will fail. I can't think of too many companies where technology applied in the right way isn't an unbelievable lever for the company, and the right CIO interacting with the right head of marketing, the right head of operations, the right head of client service, the right CFO, the right CEO, that combination is lethal in a positive way. But most importantly, I think it brings the CIO into the forefront of the company, where you're not just talking about the human resource systems and the financial systems, you're really talking about the revenue producing systems, the client care systems. And then the innovation just follows because people believe in it. You have to be an evangelist, just like the CFO is an evangelist for funding and treasury and financing the company.
I'd love to close on a more general question about trends. You keep your fingers on the pulse of where smart money is investing. Obviously, you have the innovation agenda and a product development agenda on top of that within the organization. What are some business and technology trends that particularly excite you as you look, say, 3-5 years out?
I always go back to, it's been right for the last few years, and it's still where I follow the innovation. It's really around cloud, mobile, social, data security. In those five aspects of the world, you can find innovation that's changing the way consumers behave, corporations behave, even economies and social behavior. So the innovation, if you bucketed things in those categories, it would be a winner. I also think that blockchain and some of the capabilities that it brings to simplifying the way that transactions occur. I think about blockchain and trading. I think about blockchain and our gift, digital gift businesses. I think about it in the way we do settlement and clearing. It's really a next generation capability to, I think, manage consistency, fraud, security, and then, just an infinite ledger of the truth, the record of truth. So I think if I took those first five things plus forget early applications of blockchain, just kind of what it represents in the future, I think those are key themes. And, you know, look, trading systems and payment systems, a tremendous amount of similarity. And even in the revolution, the way that, you know, you issued orders to an exchange, the way that you then, you know, crossed orders before they got to exchange, the time at which you got to liquidity pools, you know, which in some ways have rendered exchanges a little bit less value or, you know, a little bit, value them a little bit differently because a lot of things can happen away from the exchange. It's kind of what happens with payments. You know, the same things will happen. Do you need all these intermediaries? What happens in, the different aspects of authorizing a transaction, securing a transaction, providing loyalty to customers and consumers, delivering rewards, all the analytics that go with it. It's incredibly similar, which is why I think I love this job so much, because I loved financial services and trading systems. And I like, I like payments because it's fast, it's creative, it's crowded, and it's where there's a lot of mind share and venture capital money going. So it means that there's going to be a lot of change. So if you love change, it's a great place to be. If you don't love change, don't be a CIO.
Well said. Well, Guy Chiarello, thank you so much for a great conversation and joining us on the Forum on World Class IT.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.